Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Well Women Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Laura. Today, I have a very special guest, my friend and colleague, Dr. Megan Boucher. Dr. Megan is a naturopathic doctor practicing in Georgetown, Ontario. She has a special interest in treating women's health and children's health, and she is a big believer in promoting healthy, balanced eating from day one. She loves helping families navigate the confusing world of health. When she's not in her clinic, she'll often be found in the kitchen creating delicious and healthy meals or out hiking with her boyfriend, Andrew. Hi, Megan.
Hello, Laura.
Thank you for coming on today.
Thanks for having me. We have a
really exciting topic and kind of a controversial topic to talk about. So this has been something that's been in the news. People have probably seen the CBC Marketplace all talking about this. Today we are talking about food sensitivity testing. So I wanted to hop on here with yourself because I know you're very knowledgeable on the topic and just kind of talk about the ins and outs and answer a few questions with respect to the food sensitivity test.
For sure. It's a topic I get asked about a lot in clinic.
Yeah, and patients are confused, right? Because there's so much information out there and they don't really know what's real and what's not.
Yep, exactly.
So let's just start right from the beginning. So what's the food sensitivity test? How does it work?
So the food sensitivity test that I use is a blood test. So I think you use the same one.
Yep.
So it is testing the blood for basically these immune cells called immunoglobulin G antibodies, or just IgG antibodies for short. So it's testing your blood for the presence of these IgG antibodies that are created basically against different food proteins.
So that's basically kind of the simple answer of it all, right?
Yeah. The important distinction, I think, here is that it's testing for sensitivities. So this isn't testing for allergies. It's not testing intolerances or food sensitivities.
Yeah, so give me that lowdown, allergies versus food sensitivities, because that's something that people ask all the time.
All the time. Something I always make sure that I talk to people about is this is not testing allergies. So whereas allergies are created from a different type of immunoglobulin called immunoglobulin E, this is immunoglobulin G. So allergies are going to be a lot more serious and a lot more immediate than the IgG sensitivity reaction, which is more of a delayed reaction. So this can take up to even 72 hours for a reaction to occur from eating one of these foods and getting a sensitivity reaction. Whereas with allergies, it's going to cause, you know, the classic things like difficulty breathing, which are much, much more serious than a sensitivity reaction would be.
Yeah. And with a sensitivity reaction too, if it's taking 72 hours, oftentimes we don't know what happened, right? If you feel brain fog in 3 days, you don't really know what it was that happened 3 days ago or what you've been eating. So that's the main distinction. And so, a lot of people will come see me and I'm sure come see you and say, I had an allergist do a test on me and nothing came up.
Yeah.
And so what do you usually say to your patients with respect to that?
So it's probably not an allergy.
Right.
The test that they're doing is just very different, right? They're different tests, and they can still have a food sensitivity and not be allergic to that food and not have anything show up on an allergy test.
Right. And that's exactly it. They're very different entities. And I think if people understand that off the drop, then you can understand kind of what the reason is that you're going to be doing either test, right?
If we think
that they have anaphylactic reactions to things, we're not recommending the food sensitivity test.
No.
That's kind of the bottom line.
Exactly.
And so a lot of people, what's the difference between doing a food sensitivity test, in your opinion, and doing the elimination diet?
So I would say the elimination diet is actually gold standard for determining if someone has a food sensitivity. So you essentially have the most commonly reactive foods. You eliminate them from your diet for a set period of time and then reintroduce them one by one. and wait that 72 hours to see if there's any sort of reaction to the food. That is gold standard for determining whether or not there's a sensitivity. The problem with that is you're eliminating a lot of different foods that you may not be sensitive to. So a food sensitivity test sort of individualizes it to patients. It tells them what's coming up as being sensitive and those exact foods that they need to eliminate, as opposed to just blindly eliminating all of the most commonly sensitive foods.
Yeah, absolutely. Go through, I'm sure people are interested to learn about the elimination diet. Just go through it a little bit to show people exactly what the process looks like, not food by food, but more in terms of like a timeline.
So usually, I mean, I give people like a week to really get their stuff together. So instead of it last, you know, I'll have people eliminate things for a full 6 weeks, but it might take 7 weeks before they really get all of their food together and really realize where these foods are hidden. So some of the foods would be wheat or grains in general, except for rice, different nightshade vegetables, dairy, sometimes nuts, depending on the people. Most proteins are still okay as long as they're not processed. So you're basically eliminating all processed foods, wheat, dairy, and nightshade vegetables. So eliminating those for anywhere between 3 to 6 weeks. And then I would say the most difficult part is actually the reintroduction of the foods, not the elimination. So over the next, you know, it could take another 3 to 6 weeks to really reintroduce everything, depending on whether or not you get a reaction to something. So you would eliminate the foods one by one, or sorry, you would reintroduce the foods one by one. And if you get a reaction, you have to remove that food again and wait for that symptom to go away before reintroducing the next food. So if you're reacting to quite a few things and you have to wait for that symptom to go away, this is a pretty lengthy process.
Yeah, and talk about the reintroduction. How are they reintroducing? How long does reintroduction take? And how long does a typical symptom take to go away before we're on to the next food?
It really can just depend on the person. So if you're reintroducing one food, you want to do that over the course of about 3 days. After that 3 days, you see, is there a reaction? If no, reintroduce the next food. If there is a reaction, it could take, you know, another 2-3 days for that symptom to go away before you reintroduce the next food.
Right. So it is lengthy and it can be probably frustrating. And then in that time frame, it's like, are there holidays? Are there special events? Are there birthday? Like, are there things that make it difficult to already adhere to quite a strict diet?
Plus it also takes a lot of awareness around your body as well. Even know if you're having a reaction. Like you mentioned something like brain fog, right? People don't always realize that might be related to a food. They might be like, oh, well, I had a crappy sleep last night, so maybe it was that crappy sleep. But could be a food reaction.
And that's also why the reintroduction it's for a few days, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you're having that symptom, brain fog, you had a crappy sleep, okay, one day. But then you do it again and you notice you feel like that again. But again, you're right. You have to be aware of what's going on in your body and how to even pinpoint if that's a symptom. So I find it very difficult. And it's okay. My next question is, how many patients do you actually have do the elimination diet?
I would say most will actually pick the food sensitivity testing.
Yeah, I would say too.
I give them the option. So I'll always give them the option of doing food sensitivity testing or elimination diet. And more times than not, they will pick food sensitivity test.
Yep. And I would absolutely agree with that. I usually lay it out. And so we'll talk about the controversies in the food sensitivity testing a little bit later on, but I find that a lot of the articles I read talk about how they almost paint us out that we're just kind of money grabbing, that it's a money grab, that it's all this, it's like $900, $500. I don't know where they're getting these amounts from, but that's not how much it costs when you see a naturopath in Ontario, at least. It shouldn't cost that.
No.
But beyond that, it is our job and our responsibility as practitioners to give full informed consent. And with that, involves all of the options. It is our job to give all of the options that we have.
Yeah.
Based on that, the patient makes their best decision. And so I don't know how you lay it out, probably similar to how I lay it out. But when I see a patient, I say, okay, now we need to like start talking about food. And so we can do this in one of a few ways, because some patients are scared to see a naturopath because they're scared what they're going to say about their food habits.
It's true.
So I lay it out in a less fearful way, let's say. So I basically say, with food, I think food has a big role, which in most patients it does. In some of my patients, they already eat a great diet and I'm not worried about it. But in most of my patients, I say food's probably playing a large role in your symptoms. I give my patients a few options. The first option, I have them usually fill out a diet diary over the course of, like, let's say 2 weeks. My diet diary also has symptoms on it. It has digestion, and then it has water intake and energy and those sorts of things. So people would fill that out. They would come back to see me and I would go over it with them in their second visit and say, okay, based on this, I see the types of things they're eating. I see the trends in their diet and I see if their bowels are even moving and all of those sorts of things. So based on that, I say, okay, sometimes like it's pretty easy to pinpoint. You're eating wraps every single day. Let's take away that. Let's turn the wrap into a bowl or a salad. Let's get rid of the actual wrap every single day, right?
Yeah.
And so that can be an easy place to start. It might not fix all the problems, but you might see improvements if there's glaring abnormalities in that. Would you agree?
For sure.
So usually I start there. So I say to patients, we can do a diet diary. We can see what's going on. It also gives me an idea of the types of foods they like and the types of foods they eat a lot. So if I'm going to make any dietary recommendations, I kind of know where to go with that. So I find that's a good tool, and that's free pretty much. So
yep.
people fill that out. It's just a matter of their due diligence of tracking things and not altering their diet, knowing that I'm going to look at it.
Right.
So I always say
being honest about it.
No judgment. And you know what? I will say my patients are very honest, like bag of chips, Reese's Pieces. I'm like, good for you.
Yep.
So I find that that's the first way. That's like the first thing I say, these are what we can do. Step number two is going through that diet diary and saying, hey, like I said, you eat wraps every day. Let's remove wraps, right? That's kind of that. The second step I tell them is the elimination diet. That's going to be the most intense. That's going to take the most amount of time. I explain to them exactly what that means. Because when you say elimination diet, some people are like, oh yeah, I can do that.
For sure.
Then you start to talk about the nuances of elimination diet. And it doesn't sound so appealing anymore.
No, it's not.
Right. And I know you've done the elimination diet.
Yep.
Multiple times.
It's tough.
It is tough. And you're a warrior. I have not done it. And I'm very, very honest with my patients. I have not done the elimination diet and I don't plan to.
Yep.
I am the person that does the food sensitivity test. Because number one, I feel like, I don't know if other people feel like this, but if I am told I'm restricted in certain foods, for a period of time, I want them.
Yeah.
I want them. Whereas on my day to day, I would say I typically eat like the gluten-free, dairy-free, like I follow a very good diet. Yeah. And then as soon as somebody says, oh, you have to do this, I'm like, oh, I'm going to eat pizza and bread and sandwich. It's like, so I don't know, but I'm very, very honest with my patients saying I've never done it and I don't plan to do it. Having said that, you are fully welcome to do it and I will walk you through it because I know how to do it as a practitioner. So I walk them through it, but honestly, 100% of the time in my practice, people go with the food sensitivity test because you pay for convenience.
Yeah.
I will say one thing though. So one person I use, because it doesn't have to be confidential, as my example is my mother. And my mom did the elimination diet and she did it very successfully. She's really like a plain Jane when it comes to eating. So for her, it was really, really easy.
Mm-hmm.
So she was just like, yep, spinach and chicken, like good times. So she liked that. And she was fine with it. And she actually found a few things that she reacted to, random things, celery. She found gluten, so she's like completely gluten-free. celery, and I forget what else it was. But anyways, so she did the elimination diet. She's pretty much gluten free. She avoids like celery or whatever else random came up. She's not doing celery juicing, unfortunately for her, because it could save her life, I've heard. So she basically eliminated these things for, I think it was a year. She was gluten free. She was doing well, but she still had symptoms. She still had these things where she was like, I can't put my finger on it. I don't know what it is. I'm gluten free. Like, she was completely gluten free. She was completely avoiding the foods that she reacted to. And so we decided to run the food sensitivity test on her because she was still like, it's been a year and I still don't really know. And you know what? There was other things that came up on the test. Now, mind you, she hadn't been eating gluten, so gluten came up green. But we will talk about that. Mm-hmm. And you know what came up for her is yeast.
Yeah.
And so I find that that's something that's really hard to gauge, whether it's the yeast or whether it's the gluten or whether it's – so that's something you really can't get from an elimination diet, I find.
Yep. That's the thing is the food sensitivity test. It's not like there are only unhealthy foods that come up positive, right? These are foods that actually would still be on an elimination diet, like things like celery. You're not going to eliminate celery on an elimination diet.
No.
Right. So I find the elimination diet can sometimes miss things that come up positive on a food sensitivity test that people remove and they're like, yeah, I feel better.
Yeah. And how many times do you see, I know I actually surprisingly a lot see rice come up.
Yeah, I know. Me too. Unfortunately, rice comes up quite often. And that usually is something that's allowed on an elimination diet because it's apparently very hypoallergenic.
Yeah. And so I actually see rice come up quite a bit. The other thing I see, and I find post elimination diet, when we're, say we go gluten free, I see corn come up a lot.
Yep. It's found in so many gluten free products. So that's the unfortunate thing. Although I don't typically allow corn on an elimination diet anyway.
No. You shouldn't, because but I find that when people kind of settle back into life and say they're going gluten free, I find the problem is they're replacing everything with corn.
Yep. Corn, potatoes, rice.
Yeah. Do you see white potatoes come up a lot?
Not really.
Really? I feel like I see it so often.
I very rarely see nightshade vegetables come up high.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I don't see nightshade vegetables. I see potato. Yeah. And so I was wondering if that's due to, like, I know potato starch is in a lot of supplements.
Yeah.
I mean, the people who it comes up in don't really eat white potatoes or French fries or like, I think it might be a consequence of processed food.
Yeah.
But that's kind of where I'm unsure. And so this is going to lead into my next question, interpretations of the test. So let's really walk me through how you go through the results with patients. And it's actually interesting because I was at a health fair yesterday and I was talking to someone who had, you use the Rocky Mountain test, right?
Yes.
So I was talking to someone yesterday who had their food sensitivity test done through DynaCare. So I don't know anything about that test, so we're not going to speak on it. Do you?
Yeah. No.
So anyways, she had done it. I guess her medical doctor can order through DynaCare.
Right.
I guess they don't use Rocky Mountain. She had said that she got the results. And now she has the results and she's at home with these results and doesn't know what to do. So presumably nobody went through the results with her. So I think that's the most important part, is kind of going through and deciding what to do as a result of the results. So walk me through what you do with patients, how you bring them through the test and kind of what you decide to interpret. Are we avoiding everything in red and yellow? Do we only eat green? Like, let's go through what the test actually looks like for people who don't know, and then how you go through that.
So when you get the results back from the test, it will categorize them by like dairy, grains, vegetables, fruits. And in those categories, we'll tell you which ones came up red, which means elevated, yellow, which means borderline, or green, which was normal. It then goes and shows you all of the foods that came up red, all of the foods that came up yellow, and all of the foods that came up green.
I find that just easier for a lot of people to look at which ones are all red, which ones are all yellow, and which ones are all green. So I'll typically go through that with my patients. And I would say it really depends on what the condition is. So if someone has really bad eczema, for example, I'll have them eliminate everything that's red and really, really limit the yellow things. So try not to have them, but if they sneak in, that's okay. And with the green things, unless there's a food that they know, because this doesn't mean that you're not still going to have a reaction to food. You're just not having a sensitivity reaction to that food. But if there are foods that come up green and they know they don't do well with them, avoid those as well. You don't want to be adding those foods in just because they came up quote unquote normal. So depending on the condition, I would say typically I'll get people to avoid everything in the red category. The yellow category, we play around with a little bit. If they're things that people wouldn't typically eat on a regular basis anyway, see whether or not you react to that. So, I don't know, plums. Let's say plums. Because I see that come up quite a bit.
I do too.
If plums come up yellow, then you have a plum once every, 4 months? Go for it and see if you have a reaction to it. But if it's something like eggs or dairy or wheat that they typically have on an everyday basis, that's got to be limited.
Right. And so what's the timeline? How are they supposed to avoid these foods forever? Is there a time where they can eat it again? Like, what do you tell people?
Once again, it depends on the condition. So avoiding, I'm just going to take eczema as a visual one, right? So avoid the foods until the eczema clears up, and then reintroduce. Once again, you're sort of doing like an elimination diet, because I still do get people to reintroduce foods to see if there's a reaction to them. If there's no reaction, it's up to you whether or not you want to keep it out of your diet or not. But if you get a flare up from eating a food, well, once again, it's also their decision, but that's a pretty good, clear indication that that food is causing an issue in the body.
Yeah, absolutely. And I find, and again, a lot of mine is digestive issues. So again, avoiding while the digestive issues go away. What if we're looking at avoiding in terms of something I know you see a lot, Hashimoto's or autoimmune thyroid conditions?
That makes it more difficult, because a lot of people don't get constant symptoms. I mean, if they do, that can help us to determine how long you need to remove the foods for. But there's a lot of foods that we know tend to be bigger triggers of autoimmune conditions, in which case, if someone's willing to keep those things out of their diet, I would say continue doing that indefinitely. If it sneaks its way in here or there, it's probably not a huge deal. But things like, you know, eggs can be a huge trigger for people, and dairy and gluten and potatoes, the nightshade vegetables in this case might be an issue. I mean, do they have to avoid the foods forever? Probably not, unless they have an allergy to them. But that sensitivity reaction may not go away. In the end, it's really their choice, depending on how it makes them feel when they eat it. I think people, when they've eliminated it for a long enough period of time, so like over 6 weeks, even 2 months, 3 months, when they reintroduce it, they know whether or not it's causing symptoms for them. And if it causes symptoms, that is totally up to them whether or not those symptoms are worth it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's like you have to decide what you really want to deal with.
Exactly.
What do you do in terms of, I know I've had quite a few patients who kind of each end of the spectrum. So let's say one patient has one thing come up that's red, and then there's maybe a handful of things that come up that are yellow, versus my patient that comes up with 15 things that are red and maybe a handful of things that are yellow. In my opinion, and for kind of sake of just not taking away everything the patient ever eats, with the patient with one thing red, we obviously remove the one thing red, and we actually also remove completely the yellow category. Yeah. And that's because obviously they don't have a ton that are red, but let's just take away everything that's reacting in general. And then my other patient with a handful of things that are yellow and a bunch of things that are red, we just focus on the red. And actually, I've done it where we focus on what I call the quote-unquote big guns with the red. So we'll do, let's say we have the glutens and the dairies come up. We have corn come up. We have rice come up. We have egg come up. And then we have a whole slew of other things. And I find when there's a whole slew of other things that they involve nuts and seeds. Do you agree?
Yep.
And so I don't know how you usually interpret this, but sometimes I chalk it up to beans and nuts and seeds are already hard to digest.
Yeah.
And so if we're already reacting to a bunch of different things, those are going to kind of also take that opportunity to cause a reaction as well. Do you agree? Do you disagree? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I see it a lot in people who, like you said, have difficulty digesting things or definitely have some sort of intestinal permeability where these foods that are already hard on the system are causing even more inflammation.
Yeah, so do you, in that case, do you have them avoid also everything, or do you have them avoid the big things, see how they feel, and kind of move forward in kind of their own elimination diet? How do you approach that when there's like 20 things that come up?
Honestly, because if something wheat or gluten comes up high and nuts come up high, a lot of people will start replacing their wheat with like almond flour, right?
Yeah.
So I have people eliminate it all.
Yep. And again, with the gluten-free, replace it with corn.
Yeah.
You replace it with rice. So I find that it's really a matter of getting rid of processed foods just in general.
Exactly.
Going back to whole foods, because when we're replacing things, I understand the need to replace things, but at the end of the day, we're kind of fighting fire with fire, right? We keep adding in something different to overcompensate.
Right. If the issue is that you're eating a sandwich every single day, it doesn't matter whether, I mean, if the food sensitivity comes up high, it doesn't matter whether that bread is made from wheat or potato or corn or rice or almond. If you're sensitive to it, you're sensitive to it. Replace it with something not sandwich related.
Can the sandwiches for a bit.
Exactly.
And I also find that when you have a lot that comes up in terms of yellow and red on your food sensitivity test, you mentioned the intestinal permeability, and sometimes, again, they can just have really severe intestinal permeability.
Yeah.
So instead of taking away every single food, I usually take away, again, go back to a whole foods diet, go back to almost like an anti-inflammatory diet instead, and then work on some gut healing, because everything else is obviously reacting. And again, I think that this really highlights the fact that there is so much interpretation with respect to what you're supposed to do with the results. And like you said, it's case dependent in terms of timeline. It's case dependent in terms of what foods you're going to actually eliminate. And I actually have a couple patients who have done the test and they keep it on their fridge. And so they know they've eliminated, they've gone through the process. We actually got them to a place where their symptoms were really doing well. And so they had decided that on their own accord that they would decide in situations if they were going to eat those foods. And they know the consequences. And they said, you know what, I'm going to a birthday party and I'm going to eat the food, and that's that. And at the end of the day, that's their decision. But in my opinion, when you're at a place where technically you're in, like, I'm going to call it remission from whatever conditions you have, and you're actually in a really good place, in my opinion, you should be able to handle little foods that may have otherwise irritated you.
Right. You're not going to have as strong of a reaction as you may have when your body was that much more inflamed.
Right. And so I tell patients that if you're sick, if you're in a high stress situation, if you've been having flare-ups, then avoid those foods.
Yeah.
But if you're in a place where you've been really good for a really long time, it may be worthwhile to eat it and see what happens. Because at the end of the day, nutrition is extremely individual. And I don't care what program, what health, whoever tells you to eat whatever diet, and that's going to make you lose weight and fix your life. I don't subscribe to that, because no. I think that it doesn't matter. We all are have a genetic individualizations with respect to what we do well with and what we don't.
Exactly.
So I think at the end of the day, you need to find a diet that works for you. You need to remove food sensitivities that you're specifically reacting to. And then you bring those back in as you see fit, as kind of you see your symptoms and those sorts of things.
Reduce the stress of being so restrictive if you know that you really don't get symptoms from a food, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like
that's worth it.
And another question I get is, you mentioned you see lots of kids. I don't see a ton of kids in my practice. That's not my main focus. But do you do the blood food sensitivity test in kids? And if so, at what age?
So it is not recommended in kids under the age of 4. I would say the youngest I've had is 6 years old. I've had people inquire about it who are younger than 4 years old, and I don't recommend it because it's just not as accurate. Their immune systems aren't fully developed yet, so it won't be as accurate as someone who is older and has a fully developed immune system.
Right, and on top of that, I also, and I'm sure you don't, we don't do elimination diets in children, so we don't want to be taking away nutrients from children. We don't want them to go through a strict restriction of certain foods when they're in a state of growth. So also when they're at the appropriate age might be a good idea. And when I say elimination, I mean, we don't do the elimination as an adult would. I certainly don't think there's anything wrong with removing dairy from a child's diet, but that's just my opinion. So I don't think, and actually the, pediatricians don't recommend dairy as a staple anymore anyways. So that's an interesting
water all the way as well.
Yeah, and you can get calcium from a lot of
lots
things.
Of other things.
The dairy industry did a really great job of making us believe that it was the only source of calcium. Yep. So there's that. But also, so if a child is having a lot of difficulties with digestion or skin or otherwise, those seems to be the common issues, and they're, let's say, 5, it actually might be a better idea to do the test, because you certainly wouldn't be doing an elimination diet for 8 weeks.
And in that case, I'll typically do a food log and take a look and be like, this kid eats cheese 3 times a day, every single day, and they're constipated. That's a good place to start.
Right. Yeah. And that's exactly, and that's honestly where I start with every patient, just to get an idea, because regardless of if we end up doing the food sensitivity test or we don't, if we do the elimination diet or we don't, I still want to see what they eat, what their preferences are, because sometimes the answer is right in front of our face, right? Like you said, if you're having cheese 3 times a day and you're constipated, okay, possibly let's take that out. If you see something that they're eating all the time, when you're living it, you don't really realize, right?
Exactly.
You just go about your day and you're like, yeah, that's what I'm doing. When someone else, a clinician looks at it with a fresh pair of eyes and can really say, okay, what do I know about these foods and what am I seeing in these symptoms and how can I relate this? Then that can be a good place to start, and you don't actually need the test at all. In some cases, and in a lot of cases, patients will come asking for the test.
Yes.
And I actually don't, I'm not the type of practitioner that just gives a test when it's asked for, because I say, I'm glad you've done your research. I'm glad that you know about the test. However, I like to do my full initial intake. And then based on that, I say, okay, here are the issues I see and here's where we should start. And sometimes it's not food sensitivity testing. Actually, oftentimes it's not food sensitivity testing. Especially if people come and they're looking for a test, let's say a food sensitivity test, and I think something like hormone testing would give us more information. Yep. then I may actually recommend that, because I would rather them put their resources into a test that I find more value in their health than something that they've maybe seen a friend do or whatever.
Or else. If they're having symptoms that seem more serious than what a food sensitivity might cause, like if they have something like chronic diarrhea or blood in their stools, you're not going to run a food sensitivity test, right? That might be better to run.
No.
Test. So I've definitely had those conversations with people too, where they come in wanting a food sensitivity test and walk out with something totally different.
Yeah. And I also think that highlights the importance of seeing a healthcare provider who's educated, because at the end of the day, there are lots of different people. And I think that's the problem in a lot of these marketplace reviews, is they're talking a lot about, I guess, random people who can promote and give these tests. Like they mentioned people at gyms and all these sorts of things. It's definitely not naturopathic doctors that are all recommending them. There's definitely other people who can and have access to these tests. And so I think that that's what it all comes back to, is getting a full intake and knowing that you're seeing a medical professional who can accurately advise you on what the best option is for you, right? Whether it is food sensitivity testing, a lot of times I'm looking at everything and I'm saying, you know what, I need you to see your doctor, and we need to do a colonoscopy, or I need the results of that imaging because I need to see what we've ruled in and what we've ruled out. Or maybe you should do a celiac disease test, or like our job is looking at red flags and being able to rule out those more serious things. So when I see these marketplace or whatever other articles, and they talk about how the food sensitivity test can be dangerous because we're ignoring possible anaphylactic reactions and other serious things that can be going on. My rebuttal to that is saying, well, you don't have a proper practitioner,
right?
Because you shouldn't be ignoring those things. Those are things that you need to be ruling out first visit. So I think that it's finding a practitioner who can look at your condition and say, okay, I'm not just going to say, take this supplement and do this test. It's like, it's a lot more than that. Like, we do a lot more than that.
So much education goes into it as well, right? Like educating the patients. Like, I think there was one article that was talking about, it came up negative on the IgG test, but they have an anaphylactic allergy to it, so it might make people think that it's still safe to eat. That's when the conversation has to come around. This is not an allergy test. If you are allergic to something and it comes up negative on here, don't eat it.
Yeah. Like, you are not having a delayed reaction to this food. You are having an immediate reaction, which is a lot more serious. It is life-threatening, and it has nothing to do with the food sensitivity test. And I think that if someone came in and told me, I'm allergic to shellfish, and we were talking about all their issues, I probably wouldn't recommend the food sensitivity test, unless there were other glaring reasons to do so. But it wouldn't have anything to do with their shellfish allergy. Now, another thing I get a lot, and you probably get this too, and I think we touched on this a little bit, but let's go into it a little bit more. Foods that come up that you've never eaten. Mm-hmm. So let's say a food comes up that on one end, a food comes up, you've never eaten it. Secondly, if you already avoid a food, so let's say gluten, and it comes up, will it come up? And if it doesn't, what do you do with that information?
So first, with the foods that come up that you've never eaten, Rocky Mountain actually has a really great booklet about cross-reactivity. So foods that come up high that really can be related to something completely different that you might not think is related. So, for example, there are a lot of foods that can come up high that cross-react with birch pollen, or I think latex is another one that you'll see come up as a cross reactivity. So for someone who has seasonal allergies, know they're allergic to birch, and something like, I think mustard is one of the cross reactivities there. So mustard comes up high, that could be a reason, even if they never eat mustard. Bananas, I think, is another big one.
Latex. I think. Yeah.
So those could be reasons, if it's not actually the food, but something that the immune system is reacting to that looks similar to that food protein.
And so with that, do people who have a birch allergy, do you make them avoid those foods that are in that family, or do you tell them to kind of take, like, watch how they react, or what's the protocol
Yeah,
there?
so I'll typically give them the list of all the foods that are in that family and just have them pay attention to it. And you know
And do you
what?
find that
I haven't seen this yet, but I wonder if eliminating those foods might help during allergy season with those allergies. I don't know.
Well, and I was actually just going to say, and do you find that if people, so say they have an allergy to birch and those foods that are related to birch, do you find that during allergy season they might react worse to these foods, and then off of allergy season they might not?
I
I don't
don't know.
know.
Haven't seen it, but something that I will pay
Yeah.
attention to. And in
Interesting.
terms of if you've eliminated a food, will it come up? I would typically say no. So if you have not consumed that food, you know, in the past year, the past few months, it is less likely to cause a reaction. But so my boyfriend, Andrew, just did a food sensitivity test on himself. He had been avoiding gluten, so wheat, for 4 months before doing the test. And when he did the test, it came up in the yellow. And
Oh,
he was
wow.
very strict, did not have any. So it still did come up
Yeah.
in the yellow. So in terms of, typically we're told if you haven't had the food in the past, you know, 4 weeks before doing the test, it's unlikely to come up high. But I guess it depends on your level of reactivity. If you're very reactive to that food, it is probably more likely to come up high, even if you've avoided it.
Yeah, and I have a couple Hashimoto's patients who have been gluten-free, and we've run a test to see what else, because again, the glutens and the dairies are the quote-unquote obvious ones, but I find a lot more comes up. And I find I run tests where dairy doesn't come up and other things come up and gluten doesn't come up. And so I think that it is worthwhile. It's not always the glutens and the dairies, but it's a good starting place. But I had a patient who was avoiding gluten for like a couple of years, and their gluten came up zero. And so my recommendation was still avoid it because of the autoimmune component of the condition. And also another thing that I find that comes up, and I'm not sure if it comes up with you as well, but eggs, I find it differentiates egg yolk and egg white. And I find people react to egg white and not egg yolk. So what do you tell them with that?
Avoid eggs. Who's going to eat
just
egg
eat
yolk,
the yolk,
right?
Who's gonna, just I boil mean, your eggs and eat the yolk.
If they want to, sure, go for it. That's kind of whatever, that works, but it's easier to just avoid eggs.
Yeah, and I find that like things like egg yolk are in more things than egg white in terms of like dressings and sauces and stuff. So I always say to people, like, if it's egg yolk, then you're probably okay. Like if you need to have that sauce and it has egg yolk, that's okay. And then what was I gonna say? Lost my train of thought. I often have patients who are avoiding, so they go to do their test and they say to me, okay, what do I have to be eating in this next time period to do the test?
Right.
And I always just say, just go do the test, because whatever you're eating, you've been eating. Like that's what you eat.
Yes.
Unless they've been doing any specific sort of diet. But people often are like, well, I need to go eat a variety of foods so that, but I'm like, but if you don't, then that's your life.
Yeah.
Like that, it's
don't
not,
start
you don't
adding
need to
new
create.
Foods in.
Yeah. You don't need to create a situation because you want to see, because again, it's, are they going to add in papaya one time and then never eat it again? Like, so that's the one thing. The other thing is, do you run the basic panel? Do you run the enhanced? Like, what do you run the most?
So this also is a choice for the patient because of cost, obviously, but I will show them what foods come up on the basic, what are included in the enhanced on top of the basic. And basically, if they eat on a more than 4 foods on the enhanced list, it's worth it to do the enhanced test, because we can do individual add-ons. So if someone's only really eating 2 additional foods from the enhanced test, those additional add-ons can be added. If they're eating four or more, it's going to cost them more to add on just those four foods than it will to add on those additional 80 foods.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I do, is show them kind of the different foods in the different categories and say, which ones do you eat the most? And if they don't really eat it, it's kind of not really worth it. But yeah, it is worth it if you're eating the foods to just look at them all.
Well, it's some common things like blueberries, sweet potato, chickpeas, I think
flax, quinoa, right?
Quinoa, yeah. There's already five things that people typically will eat on a more regular basis. If they were to add those five things be an additional $125. If they're just going from basic to enhanced, it's only an additional $100. So it's actually just worth it to do the enhanced one.
Yeah, definitely. And then a couple other things. I know we talked about the elimination diet, not doing it in children. I also just want to note that you don't want to do an elimination diet in breastfeeding or pregnancy, just to throw that out there. Yeah. Usually, and unfortunately,
I was going to say, baby is having a reaction to something, right?
Like right.
I've seen that too, where the mother has to eliminate certain foods the most. Once again, it's really just sort of five of the most common allergens, and see if that helps with the baby's condition.
And do you, in that case, would you run a test?
No.
Or would you say, let's remove dairy, try removing gluten?
Yeah.
And I would agree with that. I'm just saying you don't want to do a full-on elimination diet in those conditions, because breast milk supply will decline rapidly. Yeah. And we don't want to take away nutrients from a pregnant woman as well. So that's important. And then I know we've kind of touched on this, but someone had a question that they said, doesn't everyone end up gluten-free, dairy-free anyways? So why would you run the test?
No, I don't actually find that. So
no, I don't either.
Dairy, I find, comes up more often than wheat.
Yeah.
But I have had people who have only had yellow reactions to foods. Or, I mean, I take myself as an example. I did the food sensitivity test and I had nothing come up high. Nothing. Not a single thing. Which,
that's great.
It's great. It's a little bit disappointing, but
yeah.
So no, these don't always come up high in everyone.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree with that as well. And what do you do when someone has, so for people that don't know, gluten comes up as gliadin.
Yeah.
And so that's the protein. And so we have gliadin as one of them, and we have wheat.
Yeah.
What do you do if you have wheat come up, but gliadin not?
I've never seen a gluten-free wheat, so
wheat. Yeah, I know, and it's such a strange, like, yes, you're reacting to the wheat, but it has gluten, so and that's what I explain to patients. I'm like, this is a component. I don't understand why they're separated.
I think it's really just if they are sensitive to gluten not wheat, you still have to avoid all those other things that contain gluten, right? Whereas if they're sensitive to wheat but not gluten, it's likely a different wheat that they're sensitive to. But by removing wheat, you're also removing gluten found in wheat. But you probably don't have to avoid gluten altogether in all of the other gluten containers.
Which, and for people who don't know, gluten is a filler in a lot of things. It's in a lot of sauces and that sort of thing. So it is probably easier to be wheat-free than gluten-free.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting distinction to make. And so what conditions would people consider getting this testing for? And what does the research say? I have a couple studies here. If you want to go over some of the conditions or some of the studies or whatever else.
Yeah. So I would say some of the best research is digestive related conditions. So IBS and IBD, inflammatory bowel disease, is a big one when you look at the studies in terms of what they're looking at and the improvements that removing those IgG foods can have on quality of life and the symptoms that they're having, and even improvements in the inflammation in their bowels. So I would say people with IBS, those would be the two biggest ones. There's also research for things like migraines and obesity, less on things like eczema, but clinically I find it to be very helpful. And then things like joint pain is a big one, feeling inflamed, anything where people have inflammation involved, I find this test to be helpful.
Yeah. And on top of that, I have a patient with IBD, and with the removal of foods, the first symptom was actually losing weight because of that inflammation, right? Some of that digestive improvements, obviously, but losing weight due to the inflammation. And I find that, again, with the research, people have to understand when it comes to research, you really need to, like, a randomized control study really needs to be set up in a way that is, we're able to get statistically significant data from. Mm-hmm. So it is difficult, and you have to make sure that everybody is doing the test, following the diet the exact same way, doing the reintroduction the exact same way. And we've talked about the personal individual nuances when it comes to that kind of stuff. So some of these conditions are harder to gauge in that respect. Yeah. With something like eczema, we're going by the how it looks, right?
Physical symptoms, really. Yeah.
Exactly. And so some of these conditions have specific markers. We can measure it. We can see them reduce. But some of them don't. And so that's the thing as well. And so IBD has great research because we know kind of the pathophysiology of IBD, right?
Yep.
But some people are just bloated. And what's the pathophysiology of bloating? And how do we measure that? And what sort of markers are we looking at? We don't really know. We're looking at perceived reduction in bloating.
Yep.
And clinically, I've seen a lot of that. And I'm sure you have as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the research on migraines was great as well. Looking at, again, we're removing the foods, and then we're seeing how they do. And migraines was a huge thing that was linked to foods as well. So there's a lot of different conditions. Like you said, a lot of the research is digestive, but there's a lot of other things. I wouldn't say this is the go-to test for weight loss, but it certainly can be a side effect of removing inflammatory foods.
Yep.
So I think that's great as well. And so we've touched on a few of the controversies, but I want to go over a couple of the tests specifically. And I want to talk about specific things I found in the article, and then you tell me what your thoughts are.
Okay.
So this one article, what is it called? Let's see. It is talking about 5 reasons to disregard the food sensitivity tests.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of goes through different reasons. And basically they're saying that the main take home point I got from the article was that there's no research and people don't get benefit. And then they list some studies to support their points.
So they cherry pick the studies is what you're saying.
Yes. So 2010 study, I don't actually really understand the study, so you can...
No.
Did you look at it?
Yeah.
So basically, they found people that were recovering from a cow's milk allergy. I don't know what that means.
I don't know what that means either. Nope.
And so they found that in these people who were recovering from a cow's milk allergy, their IgG, so if you recall, IgG is what's tested in the food sensitivity test, the IgG increased as they recovered, which mm-hmm. they're saying that means that they were just more tolerant. So as IgG went up, their tolerance to cow's milk went up.
So do you know whether they were testing IgG total or IgG4 in that?
Unclear.
Study? Unclear, yeah. So I have no idea whether or not that study is even relevant.
I also don't know what recovering from a cow's milk allergy means. So I think that's the other thing. It's like, how are they monitoring? How are they measuring recovering from a cow's milk allergy? I don't know. So there's that one study. And so this is my point in adding this in, is that you really need to be critical with what people are using. People throw around the word study and research all the time. And it's really, we have to be critical and saying, what's your take home point, right? And so also in this test, that had nothing to do with testing for food sensitivities with IgG.
Right.
They were just measuring IgG and people were recovering from a cow's mouth allergy. And who's to say that they were even recovering? Like, I don't even know what that means. So anyways, another study, 2009, they looked at infants with eczema. Again, nothing to do with the food sensitivity test, nothing to do with measuring the IgG total, removing the food and looking at symptoms. That's what the test is.
Right.
And so what they're doing is they're taking studies that talk about different IgG testing and they're using it to prove points in or against the food sensitivity test its validity, right? And so this test looked at infants with eczema. They tested their IgG levels and they found that they had the highest levels to foods they have likely been eating.
So maybe they're sensitive to those foods.
Yeah, they have eczema. They have eczema. Let's not forget. So,
but once that's again, was that testing IgG total G4?
And I don't know. And yeah. So this last test was actually looking at IgG4. And okay. So,
which is, it isn't relevant to the discussion or the testing that we do, which looks at total IgG.
Yes, which is very different. So that was the one, article. And so if you were to read this, like I'm reading it and I'm like, oh, this sounds convincing. Yeah. Their points are that it lacks clinical validity. And that's where I found all the research, that it proves false promises because it's very pricey. And again, they talk about these $500, $900 tests. And I don't know, the basic test is $275. So yeah. That's how much it is. So if you're paying more than $300 for this test, the basic food panel, not the enhanced, then you need to look elsewhere.
Yeah.
And like I said, the test we're talking about is the Rocky Mountain test, the blood test. And so I've actually had patients approach me with the hair test.
Oh, yes.
Have you heard of this?
I've heard of it. I feel like there are ads on Facebook about this all the time.
Yes. You know what it was? It was a Groupon. It was okay. A Groupon.
Yeah.
My patients got a Groupon. And so I've actually had a report be brought in because they got it done. And I looked at it and I don't know. It looks at everything up to like food dyes.
Yeah. I tried to look into whether or not you can even accurately test IgG levels in hair and could not find a single thing on that.
Neither. And that's why I wanted to ask your opinion as well, because I hadn't seen anything either. So I think that might be where, and that's where we have to look at kind of drawing the line with respect to validity and evidence base. We're actually talking about the blood test. We're talking about the Rocky Mountain one because that's the one we know. But we're not talking about the hair test when we talk about
no.
This. And then their point number three was lack of symptom improvement. And that was, it's like, I don't know what they're basing that off of.
No, exactly. The thing is, I think a lot of these articles, unfortunately, are based on opinion. They aren't looking at the research. So if you actually go and look at the research, yes, for sure. There are studies that say removing these foods does not improve symptoms more than the control group. But you look at a lot of other studies and it does show an improvement when removing these foods. So yeah. It depends who they're testing. But the other thing is I find a lot of the subjects that they're talking about in these articles are people who have no symptoms. This reporter decided to go and get this test done and they removed the foods and they didn't notice anything. Well, I wouldn't be running this test on that person anyway.
Exactly. And it's like, how are you monitoring? Because you're monitoring symptoms.
Yeah.
So if you don't have symptoms, how can symptoms go away?
Right.
And a lot of these tests that are finding nothing, it's like, how long are they removing the foods for? Not to mention, like you said, do these people even have symptoms?
Yeah.
What are they monitoring? And their last point is unnecessary dietary restriction. And I will quote, they say, the most concerning, however, are the children and people with serious medical conditions, i.e. kidney failure and cancer treatment, who have their diets severely restricted based upon IgG tests.
I don't know who is removing those foods from people in those conditions.
I wouldn't be running a food sensitivity test on somebody with kidney failure. I think with your kidney failure, the first step would be a food sensitivity test.
No.
So
clinically, I think just clinically, these articles aren't relevant because they aren't being used on the population we would be using these tests on.
Yeah, exactly. And that's pretty much my point, is people can get caught up in seeing these articles. When you see an article that says 5 reasons to disregard the food sensitivity test, it causes concern, right? Yeah. It leads you to believe that you've been misled. If you've had a food sensitivity test done by your naturopathic doctor, it's likely there was a reason. Mm-hmm. And so the point that I'm trying to make here is that 5 reasons to disregard these articles is basically is the take home point. And so there was another one by the National Post. I don't want to ignore. Basically, they're claiming, again, they claim that these diets can lead to nutritional deficiencies and useless anxieties.
I don't know how it would lead to nutritional deficiencies. If you're working with a qualified healthcare practitioner who is able to navigate that with you.
Absolutely. And we touched on all of that. And then they're saying that it misses actual allergies. We've talked about that.
Yes, it does.
Not testing. That is absolutely true. It is missing actual allergies. It is not testing IgE. This is the article that said people are paying $900.
Right.
I don't know who's
charging $900.
Don't go to them. If they say it's $900, don't get the test there. And saying people who do well are due to a placebo effect, I didn't find anything backing that up. No. And it seemed to be opinion.
Yeah.
Another one by Global News. Basically, again, it's a reporter doing the test. And they said, I looked at the results. Okay, so they interpreted their own results as a first point. Yeah. I looked at the results and it decided to avoid eating straight up egg, whey, and almonds. First of all, I want to know what eating straight up egg, whey, and almonds means. Does that mean that they're not? Mean
like eggs, they'll still eat eggs that are baked into something, but they won't.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, just eggs.
So they're truly not avoiding anything if it's just avoiding the physical food. Yeah. Then she says, it's pretty much useless because there's no body of research that supports the use of this test to diagnose adverse reactions to food or to predict future adverse reactions.
So once again, this is someone not looking at the research.
Yes. So that's kind of that. And then the person who avoided the food 7 years later acknowledges that their food sensitivity test might not have been valid and that her lifestyle might have contributed to her health issues. It is possible the naturopath I went to took advantage of my situation, she said. But even though McBroom says she no longer fully follows the results of her IgG test, she stays clear of some foods that appeared on her list.
All right.
Like, I don't even know what that means. So once there's again, that.
It's a pin.
Yeah. And then she concludes, by seeking advice from healthcare professionals, patients can ensure they aren't taking away important foods from their diet, like whole grains and certain vegetables, for example. So it's lack of education, really.
For sure.
That whole grains are a really important part of our
diet.
I think
when people say that, they're really referring to fiber. And we can make sure that people are getting fiber from a ton of other foods.
Absolutely. And that's another education. It's the navigation of going through the nuances of the test, looking at the results of the test, and making sure that we're, again, like everything else, giving individualized care and individualized recommendations. Like you said, it's based on the condition. It's based on the symptoms. If you have a patient that has no symptoms, why are you running the test?
Right.
And so that's the problem, is these reporters are saying, I'm going to run the test and write an article. And they have no symptoms. So what are we monitoring?
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Or they have no symptoms that they're aware of.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just because you don't have frank diarrhea doesn't mean you don't have some sort of food sensitivities. And the other thing is, I've had people say that they're lactose intolerant. So will that come up?
The answer is no.
No.
Lactose intolerance will not be shown on this test because it's not testing intolerances. It's testing sensitivities.
Yeah. And it's also looking at proteins, not sugars.
Yeah.
So when we're looking at the food sensitivity test, we might have casein come up. We might have whey come up. But lactose isn't on there because lactose is a sugar.
Yeah.
So, and also if you're lactose intolerant, you know that, right?
For the most.
If dairy gives you an upset stomach, you want to avoid it.
Yeah.
The test isn't going to confirm or deny that. So again, I think it's about just having a qualified practitioner decide if, number one, the test is for you. Number two, interpreting the test properly to get the best results, and kind of following the guidelines that your practitioner is giving you so that you don't have nutritional deficiency. So you're not having a restricted diet and that sort of thing. And
I think, right?
Unnecessarily. And I think that's really the take home point. Do you have anything else that you wanted to add or that we didn't talk about?
I think we touched it all.
Yeah, I think that was a pretty thorough explanation. If you guys have any sort of questions, you can always send me an email, laura@laurapiper.com. Megan, Dr. Boucher, where can everyone follow you on Instagram? Where's your website? Where can they reach you?
My website is meganbouchernd.com. meganbouchernd.com. Instagram handle, is that what you call it, a handle?
Yeah. Yes.
Also Megan Boucher ND, and you can find me on Facebook, Megan Boucher ND. I made it very simple. It's the same everywhere.
Yeah, so everybody can find you. I will also put that information in the description of the episode so you guys can check her out. Thank you so much, Megan, for joining me today. And thank you for listening to this episode. Bye, guys.